Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss, and I've been closely tracking the ETF space for more than 13 years through a variety of roles here at SeekingAlpha.com. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investing goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of the individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. Brief bit of housekeeping here. There will not be a show next week. Martin Luther King Day. The market's closed on Monday. I need to focus on a couple of other things. But the good news is we'll be back after next week with a bunch of weeks in a row of episodes without any breaks for a while. So look forward to having you all tune in. We've got some great, great guests coming up. For reference purposes, this show is being recorded on the afternoon of Wednesday, December 30th, 2020. My guest today is Bruce Liu, PhD and CFA. Bruce manages the Esoterica NextG Economy ETF, ticker symbol WUGI, or WUGI. WUGI is Esoterica's active ETF investing in a 5G-enabled digital economy. Prior to Esoterica, Bruce was a portfolio manager and partner at FaZe Capital, an equity strategist at WisdomTree Asset Management, and a sell-side equity strategist at Sanford Bernstein. He received his PhD in business administration from the University of Connecticut, holds the Chartered Financial Analyst designation. Anyway, welcome to the show, Bruce. We got a great conversation planned today on one of the hotter sectors out there right now, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Hi, Jonathan. Thank you for having me here. It's a great pleasure.
Yeah, sure. We were talking right before we hit the record button here, and I don't think this is a very controversial topic to you or I or to most people, but there certainly are some conspiracy theories going on around 5G. So maybe we'll, if we got time, we'll have a little fun with that. But in the meantime, first of all, I just wanted to congratulate you on the incredible performance of the fund out of the gate. The fund launched on March 31st, 2020, and it is up nearly 100% since launch, which, okay, granted, you happen to have great timing, very prescient. I don't know if it was luck or you knew that the market was going to bottom around then. But even starting at those kind of low prices, a 100% return is obviously nothing to scoff at. So congratulations on a hell of a almost first year.
Thank you very much. You know, we are very, very lucky and being able to launch the fund at almost the bottom of the market.
Yeah.
And that was the first, like, right decisions we have made. And the second, you know, the whole pandemic and just pulled, you know, this digital acceleration, digital transformation, you know, forward 2 years, 3 years, you know, people give you different answers. We're definitely benefiting from that. So we're very, very, very much blessed and being able to, you know, deliver good performance to our investors. Hopefully
yes,
we can keep it up.
Definitely. Yeah, that's always the trick. So I'd love to start at the very beginning here. And that is, let's just explain to people, what is 5G and what sorts of advances does it represent over current infrastructure 4G?
Okay, I can definitely explain that. I actually get asked many, many times. And the 5G is very simple. It's just a fifth generation of, you know, wireless communication versus a 4G. And compared to 4G, and the three things that people have to keep in mind. You know, first, it's very faster, 10 times faster than 4G. And second, latency. It's 10 times like a decrease in latency. You know, you get to work on things very, very, you know, fast. Third, and that's capacity. Compared to 4G, you get like 10 times more capacity, the number of, you know, devices you can connect to the wireless network. So three things together make it 5G is so much more powerful as a communication standard, you know, protocol. And people have been working on the 5G. I actually started like a 2013, 14, and the fully, you know, the 5G standard got frozen middle of last year, 2020. And you know, people keep like developing the new standard and making this is better. And that's in a nutshell, that's about the 5G.
And in terms of the transformation from 4G to 5G, how much of the way, let's say, are countries that have really been kind of pushing the infrastructure forward, like the United States, how far along are they in terms of getting us to 100% 5G saturation?
That's a very good question. You know, I actually believe we are just at the very beginning of this 5G cycle. Actually, you know, I want to make that point. When looking at 5G, we just don't just look at the 5G itself. It's all about the 5G cycle. And I'll get to that point later on. But, you know, for your question, the deployment by different countries, this is where actually 5G is a little bit different from 4G. 4G is all about the US. US started on their own and exported the everything to the rest of the world. But in 5G, and at least you get like two horses racing, both in China and in US. But in terms of a deployment so far, South Korea is the first country have this, you know, national commercial 5G network.
I was going to say, yeah, they actually belong in the conversation. Absolutely.
Exactly. But why, you know, China and US are more important? It's just purely because of the size of the market. China became very aggressive starting from like 2019. They have this national priority, strategic priority to deploy 5G network, you know, allocate the spectrum to all the carriers and to buy the equipments, started deploying the 5G commercial services. That's all started like 2019. And the pandemic hit, you know, early 2020. That slowed down the process a little bit. But, you know, once they recovered and they keep pushing, that is still going on. But again, still very early stage. And if you look at the 5G cycle, you don't even have the reliable 5G services yet. And most of people are still using the 4G network. And how China does it, they rely on, you know, in the 5G world, there are two spectrums. One is called sub-6, which is easier to deploy. And another one called millimeter wave, which is technically harder to deploy. China chose like sub-6 to start. Well, the situation in US is a little bit different because in US, you don't have much, you know, sub-6 spectrum available. Also in US, this is all private investments. You know, that's the difference from China. China is a national action, you know, but in US, you really have to rely on AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile to spend much money to put a 5G network in place. Also, because we don't have much like sub-6 spectrum available, they have to take on the millimeter wave, which is more costly and technically more challenging to deploy. So that's where US, you know, was a little bit of falling behind. But this year they made like a big, last year, 2020, they started like making push and significant progress. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are. Both countries are still at a very, very early stage. And eventually, when you want to have like a national deployment of 5G, you need both spectrum, both sub-6 and the millimeter wave. We are way of, you know, we're still far away from there yet. So it's the beginning of like a 5G cycle, to say the least.
Nice. Yeah, that's and you definitely clarified things there in terms of kind of who the front runners are and what the process involves exactly. So in terms of looking at the markets and the types of companies or the sectors that are most likely to benefit from here, I'd love it if we could go through some of them. So in terms of building out all of the networks, who's most likely to benefit here?
That's a very good question, Jonathan. But to answer that question, let's step back a little bit. You know, I always want to use this, you know, in our opinions, at least from our perspective, if, you know, again, it's not only about 5G itself, it's about the 5G cycle and what 5G enables. I always like to use a 4G cycle as one example. So think about like, you know, because historically, every generational transition you know, of wireless connection from 2G to 3G, 3G to 4G, now we got to 4G to 5G. That's a process actually disrupting the whole technology stack and building the new one. That's why this is so significant. Take a 4G example. What 4G did, exactly. 4G created mobile internet. That's the significance of a 4G cycle. So that's where you get, you know, smartphones, right? From Apple. And we started doing everything on our phones. That's the promise of 4G, connecting people. And to a certain extent, you know, that mobile internet also accelerates the adoption of cloud. Because everything is moving to the cloud. You do much the workload in the central cloud. So that's how 4G disrupted the technology stack, getting the new ones. Then you got all the exciting applications, Instagram, you know, and the Uber, and that sort of things. That's a 4G cycle. We just believe, you know, in the 5G cycle, the same thing is gonna happen again, just at a much larger scale. Looking back, 4G is just a special case of 5G connecting people. And the 5G is connecting everything. In the grand scheme of things, we are in this continued process of digitalizing every corner of our economy. So that's the big picture when you think about the 5G and the opportunities associated with 5G, what that is about. Disrupting the technology stack we already have now, getting to the new one. Why I'm saying that, like, I'll give you a very specific example. In 4G, yeah, we do everything on our phone, right? But a lot of like workload, you know, behind the scene is all actually done, all the computation is done in the central cloud. But now when 5G promises us so much latency, speed, right? So you want to have those kind of like, you know, a more exciting and real-time engagement, you know, experience. You have to do those things, you know, in real time, which means technically, you have to move the workload closer to the edge of the cloud, the internet, make it so closer to the end users. So that's the change we are embracing in the 5G cycle. So that's, you know, changing everything, changing a computing architecture, changing how you deploy your software applications. And also because of we have the, you know, before in the 4G cycle, again, it's all about connecting people. We're all connected. Now in the 5G cycle, it's connecting things. Everything in your home, in your office, in the manufacturing site, you know, on the road, it's gonna connect it. So you get so much going on the edge. We have to incorporate that. So much data is gonna generate it. I can go on and on, but I guess you get the idea.
Yeah, sure. No, it's fascinating. So people have talked about the Internet of Things, obviously, for a while now, but it sounds like anything they've talked about will pale in comparison to what happens once 5G really is deployed broadly.
Exactly. You know, to bring a step further, when people, you know, we have this 3GPP, they design, you know, they define all the like 5G, what 5G is really about, what's in 5G, what 5G should achieve. This time around, on purpose, it's not only about 5G itself, they focus so much on the 5G use case. So the 5G is no longer about the mobile network itself. It's about the vertical use cases. So when they define 5G, they actually put the industrial IoT, they put the autonomous driving, they put the smart manufacturing into the protocol, the standard. So make sure like we can deliver those things. So that's why we are saying, you know, compared to 3G to 4G, 4G to 5G is no longer just like a step function. That's a totally change of the game. It's much, you know, larger scale.
That's brilliant and very exciting. And I guess the autonomous driving example is a good one because, I mean, we all know how frustrating it can be even on 4G sometimes when you don't have that lightning quick connection or it feels like your device just doesn't have the processing power to handle what's going on. And so you could see with something like autonomous driving where you really can't have any disruptions in the connection at any point or any latencies or lagginess. I could see how this would take something like that from a theoretical to something that actually becomes a reality, you know, in the next 5-10 years.
That's one of the major focuses, you know, by the when they define the 5G. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, companies like Qualcomm is pushing that hard from this, you know, chip level, semiconductor level, mm-hmm. and need a total solution to do that. Well, that's actually a very complicated subject. You know, first of all, cars have to become like very smart, smarter. You have to learn everything around you, right? How to drive on in your own car. You see, you take signals in, you do machine learning, you learn it, you become smarter. Also the coordination, that's actually the most like 5G part comes into play in this autonomous driving ecosystem. Because you have to coordinate everything around you. It's called V2X. And the cars next to you, and the signal, you know, the traffic lights, and the people walking behind you, and many other things. So that's you're right. That's the promise of 5G, and hopefully we can get there sooner rather than later.
Yeah. So I guess now is as good a time as any to just ask if you have a take on this. So I mean, this all sounds very exciting. Obviously, any new technology, it comes with with some risks or potential caveats, but why do you think it is that there is so much conspiracy thinking or paranoia going on around 5G in particular? I mean, it's almost it's almost comical if you look at some of the stuff that's out there. But the thing is, people really seem to believe this stuff. And for example, the Christmas Day bombing in Nashville, there are some strong indications that the intention of the person who did that was that he had been taken in by many of these conspiracies, and the bomb was set off right near a large AT&T facility. And so there's a feeling there may be connectedness to a lot of the conspiracy thinking. And I'm just curious, is it, you think it's just kind of fear of progress and paranoia, like Unabomber style stuff? Or what, what do you think it is exactly that gets people going with this?
Yeah, actually, that's a good question. From time to time, we get asked as well. But major questions are asked, like, what's the impact on people's health? You know, when you get like so much like wireless, you know, stuff around you, and is that gonna, you know, bring more cancer, the potential of getting caught on cancer, or like damage your brain, you know, because you're on the phone, or like you put everything, you know, so close to your body, which receives all the, you know, wireless signals. We get asked a lot about that, you know. We are not the true technical experts. We leave that the definite answer to the true technical experts. But so far, you know, this is not new. And every time, you know, history, when we have the 3G, people were worried about that too. Like 4G, nobody wants to leave too close to the like a tower, right? You just want to stay away from their antenna. Well, the 5G is a little bit different because, you know, to make 5G work, especially on the millimeter wave, you need a massive number of antennas and the base stations and the towers, you know, because you just need that to make this 5G network available. That probably makes people more conscious of these kind of things, and they'll be more worried. Also, now these days, people are a little bit, you know, that's a second aspect of this 5G. People pay more attention to their privacy. They don't want their data get leaked or like get tracked by the government and that sort of things. I think two things together really contributed to this conspiracy thing. But you know, it's nothing new. Every time, every generational transition, historically, we heard of things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember in the 90s when the first cell phones came out, and they obviously looked ridiculous compared to what cell phones are today, but everybody was convinced they caused brain cancer. Not everybody, but it was certainly something you heard regularly. And I guess at least in this case, if for whatever reason they do cause a slight uptick in certain kinds of cancers, the fact that they make data gathering so much more powerful, really on an exponential level, interconnectedness of things should go a long way towards curing cancer also. So
because actually, yeah. Even now, my mom always tell me, like, you know, don't leave your phone next to your, you know, head when you are sleeping. Put it far away.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So, all right, cool. So let's get into your approach here at Wuji. First of all, you said something interesting about the fund name itself. It's WGI. It's pronounced Wuji. Why did you name the fund that?
Well, actually, Wuji in Mandarin, that's just how like 5G, is pronounced. Mm-hmm. We just, you know, that ticker was available. We just picked it up. You know, I thought nice. It's pretty cool.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's great. So in terms of the way you're running the fund, there's already two other U.S. listed exchange traded funds covering 5G play. The first is the Defiance Next Gen Connectivity ETF, ticker symbol FIVG. I've actually had the indexer that runs those funds, Blue Star, Stephen Schoenfeld on the show before, and he spoke about the index there. Very interesting approach to building indexes and how they weight things internationally. And then there's also the First Trust INDXX NextG ETF, ticker symbol NXTG. These are both index funds. You've taken a totally different approach here in that your fund is actively managed. So how does the approach that you're taking, how does it differ from those peers? And why have you specifically decided to take an active approach here?
Well, you know, Jonathan, I can spend all day on that question, but I'll give you the short answer first and then a long answer.
Okay, cool.
The short answer is we're very, very different from both funds, you know, in terms of how we, our investing thesis and the way we invest in it are totally different. And now I'm getting to the long answer. Well, actually, this has something to do with the question you asked me earlier. I didn't really answer that yet. And so how, you know, what are the opportunities within this 5G cycle, you know, what that enables, at least from our perspective. So now, you know, given what we say, we believe this is a disrupting process. You know, 5G is going to disrupt the legacy portfolio, you know, technology stack, building the new ones. And then you love like, you know, exciting technology. 5G itself is significant and exciting, but it's not only 5G. You get many other things, you know, edge computing, AI, it's all coming together. It's all coming. We have to have that kind of like a mindset. It's not only about 5G. It's about the disrupting the legacy technology stack, getting to building the new one. So this is a pie growing story, right? This is a pie growing story. It's like back into like 2009, 2010, when you look at the 4G cycle, you ask yourself, what shall I invest in? How shall I do that? This is a pie growing story. As an investor, your goal is what? You want to find the part of the pie that's growing faster and the bigger, right? And also because of this is a disrupting process, it's going to create the winners and the losers. So as an investor, you want to just pick on the winners, get rid of the losers. And the third thing I want to add on to that is the value creation. This is a moving target along the cycle. It's not like, you know, you know this company, this kind of company is going to generate the values, you know, evenly along the cycle. They might just generate, you know, take a I'll get to that point, you know, semiconductor, for example. They might generate the values earlier than software companies, and the application companies might generate the values, you know, towards the end of the cycle. It's very intuitive, but that's what mm-hmm. it is.
Yeah.
So as an investment vehicle, as a portfolio manager, those are the things that we want to combine together, hopefully deliver better, you know, performance. And that's what we're trying to do. So that get to the point. Where are, because this has something to do with why we are different from the other two ETFs.
Sure.
What are the pies? So first question we have to ask, what are the pies that's going faster and bigger? In our opinions, we did so much research looking at the previous cycles. We identify three things, basically. Semiconductors, you know, they have this secular growth tailwind. Within semi space, we particularly focus on the wireless communication. That's more related to 5G itself, but also the high performance computings. remember we mentioned that, you know, cloud computing is gonna, you know, keep growing. We bring more computing power to the edge. We're gonna get edge computing. So that's, and then we, because of it, we get generated so much data, that's gonna help the AI modeling. Everything we do, you're gonna have the AI component. AI also needs the computing power, right? So everything boils down to the semiconductors. You need better chips, you know, high performance chips. So that's two things within the semi space. We believe they have the huge tailwinds. Then next level, softwares. Again, because the way we deploy our software is gonna be cloud native, also get to the edge of the cloud, not only just stay in the cloud, right? And that's totally change of the architecture, computing architecture. Then the way you deploy your software is gonna be totally different. The way you manage your software ecosystem is gonna be different. So that's gonna generate a new generation of, you know, software companies. And I like to take like a cybersecurity, for example. In old ways, everything in the corporate data center, right? You set up your security parameter around your corporate data center. Now these days, everybody is on the go. Everybody is you know, accessing the data application on the cloud, you know? So you stay away from your like corporate data center already. So you have to change the way you design your security system. So that's why you got the winners, like, you know, new generation of like cybersecurity companies like Zscaler, CrowdStrike, and Okta. And they have been doing this disrupting all along in this new cycle, you know, many things like that. And also like a data part mentioned earlier, what's special about 5G is connecting everything, which actually means what? Generating more data, exponentially more data. And so you have to find a way to deal with, manage that data, process that data. That's why everybody loves Snowflake, right? That's a totally different ball game. And yeah, it's disrupting the legacy, you know, technology stack. So that's the significance. Then after that, once you get all the new technology stack get built, really taking advantage of like a 5G, everything good about the 5G and along with other technologies, people are gonna build new applications. We are a little bit far away from there, but the people already talk about AR, VR, autonomous driving, and they're gonna come. We don't know when yet, but they're definitely gonna come towards the end of the cycle. You have to have the infrastructure ready, then people can build things based on that. But even today, you already are able to say, you know, like e-commerce, for example, are taking advantage of this, you know, faster speed, low latency. Not so much in US yet, but actually in China, people call it live streaming e-commerce. And was a big thing in 2019 and 2020, and huge growth potentials. It's gonna come to US and the rest of the world. And also, you know, ByteDance, that short form video, people are already like taking advantage of this already. And then mobile gaming and digital payments, you know, to the like broader sense, you know.
Sure, I see you've got PayPal and Square both in
that. That's
portfolio.
All part of the game. That's where we see eventually they're going to become more growthy and a much bigger TAM, you know, for them. That's the, you know, the opportunities we see. We believe the part of the pie that's growing bigger and faster. But on the other hand, you know, so that's where we really differ from like, you know, from other guys. There are part of the pies that we don't like. You know, it's important to talk about things we don't like. If you notice, we don't have very like, you know, household 5G names like Ericsson, Nokia. We don't have them in our portfolio. Cisco, we don't have them in our portfolio.
I was going to say, yeah, you don't seem to have much in the way of traditional networking stocks in the portfolio.
Hopefully that's the right reason. Also, we don't have AT&T, Verizon, all those, you know, carriers. We don't
have them. Well, yes, that, you know, makes a little more sense to me. And so the networking thing, I definitely want to get into. Of course, you don't have Intel in the portfolio either. AMD is your top holding right now. That play probably makes sense even without 5G.
Yeah.
And then I've also noticed, thinking back about 10 years to the 4G cycle, everybody wanted to hold the phone manufacturers because they felt there was going to be this massive upgrade cycle. And I'm just curious, I'm not seeing the Apples or Samsungs in the portfolio here either. So,
Jonathan, you always ask good questions, you know, like that's very, very good. Well, that's very, you know, you're right. We don't have any smartphone makers in our portfolio. We actually, at the early stage of this fund, we have like Xiaomi.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Chinese smartphone maker in the portfolio, but we remove it. But now we don't have any. Why we don't have any? Just think about this. From 3G to 4G, from 3G to 4G, for smartphones, that's the change from 0 to 1, right? We don't have, we didn't have like smartphones at all, you know, in the 3G cycle. All of a sudden, you know, because thanks to Apple, we have this smartphone, powerful, allow us to do so many things on the phone.
Yeah.
That's the, from 0 to 1, that change is. That marginal growth is significant. That's why Apple was so successful. That's why smartphone makers was so successful in the 4G cycle.
Yeah.
But come to the 5G cycle, it's no longer a 0 to 1 game. You just upgrade your 4G phone. It's still smartphone, right? And to the 5G smartphones. So that's no longer a 0 to 1 change. That's just from 1 to 2, maybe like, you know, that marginal growth is significantly smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in this process, what's better? It's not about the phone itself. It's about the chips in the phone. Why? Because 5G is so advanced. It requires, you know, that we call it like a semiconductor content. It's just basically you need more chips and better chips, which are more expensive. So the growth potential is so much better for the chip makers like mm-hmm. Qualcomm, Skyworth, you know, like MediaTek, rather than the phone makers themselves. So that's how we say it. And that's how we express our views in our portfolio. That's why we have all the chip makers, but we don't have any like, you know, smartphone makers. That's a significant difference between, you know, between 5G and 4G. Yeah.
Yeah.
And back to the network things, you know, it's very quickly, I want to make this
point. Yeah, sure. No, I think people will be interested to hear why there aren't those more traditional, the Ericssons and the Ciscos, as you mentioned, the Nokias, not in there.
You just think about this value chain of this technology, you know, ecosystem, 5G related. You get the chip makers on the upstream, right? Then go down the stream, you get those hardware makers, Ericsson, you know, Nokia. Then you got the carriers, AT&T, Verizon. Mm-hmm. Then you got the Apple. Then build on the smartphones, you got all the applications, basically fans, Google, Microsoft, Netflix, Facebook.
Yeah, that's sure.
So that's the value chain. So hardware makers and the carriers got stuck in the middle. So they take hardware makers, Ericsson, Nokia, look at their growth perspective and look at their margin profile. They grow like a single digit. Even we are in the middle of 5G ramp up cycle, they grow like a middle, like a single digit. Their margin, their operating margin is less than like 10%, is single digit. And this is supposed to be the best of their times, right?
Yeah.
So why that's the case? They just don't have the pricing power. They don't have the pricing power. You know, that's why they're, you know, it's not about a particular company. It's about the whole sector. It just doesn't create much value as others.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we're saying, try to pick the part of the pie that's growing bigger and faster, not the pie that just doesn't create much value, you know, because the whole purpose of investing in the 5G cycle is, you know, you are looking for growth, exponential growth. So stay on to the growthy names. Similarly, for the carriers, right? Carriers, on one hand, they have to spend so much money on the infrastructure, buying the spectrum, buying the equipment, put into the field. On the other hand, they haven't proved that they have the pricing power, you know, over against the consumers yet. You and I are not going to pay more for the 5G connectivity, I guess, right? So that's the situation they are in. That's why we don't believe over the cycle they generate as much value as other parts of the ecosystem. So that's basically how we differentiate from other, you know, ETFs. If you look at theirs, FIVG, their thesis is more focused on the 5G itself. You know, they get the carriers, they also get the semiconductors, but they get the carriers and they get the hardware makers, they get all the networks, So that's the thing. They don't have the software component in it. They don't have the application component in it. So they really bet on this build up like 5G infrastructure. You know, what happens if we're like 3 years later, when we build all the 5G stuff, or 5 years later, it's harder for them to generate additional values, right? In my opinions. Well, you know, for NXTG, NXTG actually was around for many long time. Used to call it like a smartphone ETF. They yeah. rebranded into this 5G thing.
So, but move.
They didn't. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, again, their thesis is more about smartphones, right? What goes into smartphones? So they also invest heavily in the smartphone itself.
Yeah.
As we explained later earlier. We just don't say those are the things that generate the most value over the whole cycle. We would rather focus on the ones that actually potentially give people, you know, more value. Looking back, you know, if you ask yourself over the 4G cycle, you would rather invest in Nokia, Ericsson, or you would rather invest in, you know, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Netflix. I think the answer is very obvious.
Sure. Yeah. Although I think Apple, you know, has certainly performed as well as the other names you just mentioned. And I do yeah. think the main reason people bought them at that point was because of the iPhone business and exactly. certainly driven performance. But yeah, I think the point when you get beyond Apple, clearly the performance hasn't quite been there. So, and yeah, just for people at home to just kind of drill down on your point a little more, just looking at the overlap, there is some significant amount of overlap. It's still very minimal. So it's a very different fund. But in terms of FIVG, 5G, they are also holding things like Qualcomm and Skyworks. So there's some decent amount of overlap. In terms of NXTG, there's almost no overlap with your fund, I'm seeing. But in either case, there's really very minimal overlap. And these are not carbon copies of each other by any stretch. And the point particularly about staying active, because a index doesn't allow you to evolve with the cycle, the development cycle, the fact that maybe early on in the cycle, the chip makers will be more valuable later on in the cycle. Maybe the app makers will be more profitable at that point. So I think it's a point that people don't think about enough, particularly with these kinds of niche sector plays where you're not just trying to buy a Russell 3000 style, just give me everything. I'm not going to make a bet on the market. You're making a specific play. And if you're going to make it, you may as well already use your scalpel and be very targeted in the way that you do it and not use a machete and cut down the whole forest while you're doing it. So it's really fascinating.
With so many ETFs to choose from, how do you find the ones that are best for your portfolio? Personally, I always start my ETF searches with Seeking Alpha's ETF Screener, a product I came up with and helped build in 2015. Utilizing Seeking Alpha's proprietary ETF taxonomy system and powered by data from Morningstar and CapIQ, the ETF Screener now has a greatly improved user interface. Try the brand new data sliders, allowing you to create much more granular screens and locate the funds that best match your investing style and risk tolerance. I have personally built my own ETF portfolio, as well as my three kids' college saving plans and my parents' non-tax deferred ETF portfolios, starting with Seeking Alpha's ETF Screener each time. And what's best, Seeking Alpha's ETF Screener is totally free to use. So why not give the ETF Screener a try today by going to seekingalpha.com and typing the words ETF Screener into the search bar at the top of the site.
So I'd love to get into the specific selection process here. You guys are doing a lot of research, obviously, in-house. So there's that whole qualitative factor. Is there any kind of quantitative overlay that goes in at the beginning where you're looking at what the kind of subset of businesses or companies that you should be looking at, and then you do the research from there? Or how does the, take us through the research and stock selection process a bit here.
Okay, yeah, we'd love to. You know, it's another good question. It's a very typical, you know, active equity portfolio. We combine both top-down and bottom-up. I'll talk about the top-down. So for like I was said earlier, we identify the growing part pies, right? So we think a semi and software, cloud native software and application are three, you know, sub themes we like to have exposure to. So that's the first layer of the decision making. And we decide, you know, given the cycle, for example, why now we have a more exposure to semi, we're overweight semi. So simply because we believe at the beginning of the cycle, semi get a benefit first and the foremost. So that's a decision. So we pick the semi. That's the, you know, bottom top down decision making. Then once you decide that allocation, you're within each basket pillar, within each pillar, we try to identify the winners. Winners are really disrupting this space and get the have the tailwinds to them rather than the losers who have the headwinds. Within semis, like I mentioned earlier, we try to focus on the two secular growth trends. One is wireless communication, another one is high performance computing. That's where, you know, on that part, that's why we have Qualcomm, Skyworks, and Qorvo, and MediaTek. That's wireless communication. And on the high performance computing, that's why we like AMD and NVIDIA. Well, you know, you probably noticed we don't have Intel, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, and there's obviously been a lot written about that in places like Seeking Alpha and elsewhere. But yeah, I'd love to just hear you state why you've got AMD and NVIDIA and no Intel in the portfolio.
Yeah, we are actually quite, if you look at our, you know, holding history, we got rid of, when we started, we have Intel. Intel is still a great company, have the most complete product portfolio in the semi business. But they do, in the last like 2 years, they have this manufacturing process issues. They just couldn't ramp up their, like, you know, 10 nanometer, like, you know, manufacturing process. They have so many troubles. They keep delaying it until the second quarter of this year. They admitted we had problems. The stock tanked. We actually removed that. We saw that coming. We removed the position right before the earnings.
Nice.
We come out of that. You know, we focus on this, you know, fabless ecosystem, which is the combination of TSMC, which now is the real leader in this leading edge manufacturing process, with other IC designers, which are AMD, NVIDIA, Qualcomm, and, you know, even Apple are part of this game.
Mm-hmm.
So this group, this is a new dynamic, is gaining upper hand. Well, main reason is because TSMC has been executing so well in their technologies, you know, roadmap. They keep coming up with, you know, 7 nanometer, 5 nanometer. Next year is going to be late 2021, they're going to like have like 3 nanometer in volume of production, which give Intel really, really hard time.
Yeah.
That's why Intel is losing market share. This is a new dynamic we are talking about. So you have to be able to identify the winners and try to stay away from the losers.
Yeah. And TSMC is currently the fifth largest holding in the portfolio. So another company you've definitely gone all in on, so to speak.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense. And then in terms of position sizing, how are you reaching that exactly? So, I mean, you've got your largest holding, and I just pulled these holdings now, so they should be as of yesterday's close, which would be the 29th of December. So AMD is 8.69% of the portfolio. You go all the way down to Coupa Software, COUP, which is just 49 basis points, 49 hundredths of a percent. So how are you arriving at the position sizing?
Okay. You know, mentioned earlier, we first decide that the sector exposure first, you know, we overweight the semis. So wouldn't be surprised if within the semi space, we get a lot of like overweight, right? Within the semi space, we like the AMD the best. That's a combination of many things, both qualitative and quantitative. Quantitative is more about the evaluation part. You know, you combine, you know, the growth potentials, the margin expansion potentials, the quality of management team, the competitive scenario, and then, you know, valuation is definitely in the consideration. Putting everything together, we have like a conviction level. You know, within the team, we evaluate each investing and we have a conviction level. The higher conviction level, the higher weight we put onto it within each basket. Now, on the other hand, Coupa, fantastic business, and they have been growing, you know, reasonably well. Not as fast as Snowflake, but you know, 30% plus, very consistently. They're, you know, very exciting, you know, TAM. And especially this B2P payment, you know, they are having a high hope for. The reason we have like a smaller size because of valuation, they're just too expensive. Not as expensive as Snowflake. The reason, the only reason Snowflake doesn't make the cut is because of the valuation.
Uh-huh.
It's just too hard for us to take in somebody trading at like 85 times EV to sales. This is too much to digest.
Yeah. Yeah. It's understandable.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of how you're managing the fund, and I know this is still the, you know, the first year as we're talking now, although when people listen, it will be a couple weeks into the new year. But, you know, one of the reasons that people talk about why the exchange traded fund is such a superior vehicle is because of the tax efficiency. You can run an active fund, you can trade in and out of things and hopefully not have to stick people with a tax bill at the end of the year. What kind of turnover did you see with the fund in the first year? And then were you able to actually keep the fund tax efficient in the first year?
Again, back to our investment thesis, this is a long-term, I hope people use it as really like a long-term investment vehicle. We look beyond the cycles. It's not like we don't, you know, we follow all the companies very closely, and but we don't trade around the quarters like many hedge funds do.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not our game. And we try to have a long-term view, stick to that, and adding the positions along the way. So the impact of that, our turnover is actually quite low. Mm-hmm. We do not try to make a huge moves around the quarters. And you know, we become more patient as long as the underlying thesis, you know, conviction level stays there. I did a calculation the other day. Since the inception, our turnover, one-way turnover is only like less than 30%.
Yeah. So, right. So I spoke to Dodd Kitsley at Davis Advisors last week, and they have four actively managed ETFs. They've been doing this for a bit longer than you guys. They're over $1 billion in AUM at this point. And he made the same point, and that is people always think, oh, active, the turnover must be crazy compared to indexes. And his point also was that the turnover on their funds are just significantly lower than on many index funds. And I mean, there's even index funds that literally turn over the entire portfolio every single week because they're using, you know, hedge fund like strategies. They're trying to buy whatever the biggest losers from the previous week was and basically just hold them for that dead cat bounce or whatever it is and flip them again a week later. So yeah, it's definitely, I think funds like yours are turning this notion of active is always more active in terms of turnover than passive indexes on its head, certainly. So
exactly. Well, you know, on the trading side, you know, our trading advisor is also doing a great job trying to mitigate this tax impact. And we're, you know, that's the beauty of ETF. Another beauty about ETF is this easy access. You know, it's a funny story, Jonathan.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, when we started thinking about this, you know, invest in the next cycle, what's the best idea, how we should do that, and with our partners. We made the conscious decision of doing an ETF rather than a hedge fund structure. Why? Just, you know, I want to create a high quality investment vehicles for my parents, my friends, so they get a chance to invest in it and get a benefit from there. You know, that's something we truly want. So that's why we want to do it in an ETF format. So far, you know, we have almost like a 20 million in the money. I believe most of them are the retail money.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy for that. That's the direction we want to go.
Yeah.
We want to serve this part of the market. I feel like retail investors get underserved in the previous cycle. Hopefully, you know, with our effort, we can change the game.
Yeah, totally. And retail investors have certainly driven the growth in many ETFs because, you know, many financial firms, until a fund gets to 100, 150 million in assets under management. The firms have rules. They're not allowed to touch them. They're not available through the wirehouses, you know, whatever it may be. So your fund, I'm guessing, is available on places like TD Ameritrade and on E-Trade. I'm guessing probably Merrill Edge, not yet available, if I had to guess, just because
not yet.
A lot of stuff's not available there. You either have to pay them or wait until it develops, gets enough of a following and enough assets to show up there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I'm very, very happy when you remember when Robinhood used to disclose their holding data, they stopped doing that. I can literally see, you know, the retail guys coming into our ETF. We can see this growth, which is fantastic, you know?
Yeah.
That was the exciting part of running this.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm also curious in terms of, just to get back into the holdings a bit here. So, you know, again, all the different chip makers we've discussed, like AMD and mm-hmm. Qualcomm, NVIDIA, makes total sense. I get why they're in the portfolio. And then you look at the Amazons, some of the cloud plays also that are in the portfolio here. Again, that makes a lot of sense. I am a little curious about some of the FANG style holdings here. So what are companies like Facebook and Netflix, and I guess Microsoft, you might say Azure, the cloud play element. I don't know if that's the reason they're in there, but you know, that's still not the bulk of their business. They've also, mm-hmm. I guess they're big in gaming, although I don't know how much of that is digital gaming. But so I'm just curious what those kind of massive companies, like, let's say specifically Facebook, Microsoft, and Netflix, what they're doing in the portfolio. Because it is a little surprising to see them in a 5G portfolio.
I see. The good question, you know. Remember, back to our thesis, we like SAMIs. So we like cloud native softwares, plus like cloud. Mm-hmm. And we also like the applications potentially built on the, you know, this mobile internet and 5G network going forward. Well, Facebook is definitely like fall into that category, right? So you mm-hmm. get Instagram, you know, they take advantage of this wireless communication. Don't be surprised, Instagram might be able to do some real-time engagement when everybody get hooked up fast enough. Mm-hmm. And they also have this VR game potential, not significant, but the huge growth potential.
Right.
And also social aspect of that, it's everything. A little bit less on the, you know, 2B part, you know, the connecting everything. Facebook is still more, you know, in this connecting people part of the whole ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they deserve some allocation in the portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
Microsoft, you know, that they are the core of this digital transformation. I want to, you know, guys think about this digital economy, digital transformation. Our process, you know, as a company, we use everything from, you know, so from Microsoft. It helps us to run our business.
You guys, using Teams over there?
We use Teams, we use OneDrive, you know, everything.
Okay, we use Slack at Seeking Alpha. I don't see them in the portfolio, but yeah, I see a lot of other companies that we use. So I see MongoDB here, which we use. I see Salesforce, which we use. I mm-hmm. see Team, also Atlassian Corp.
We use
Jira, of course, and Confluence to all of our tech development. So, yeah.
So that's the thing. Again, in the grand scheme of things, we are digitalizing every corner of our economy, especially in the 5G cycle. It's not only about connecting people, it's connecting things. And business are going to do everything, bring everything digitally.
Yeah.
That's where we want to you know, have exposure. I would believe that's where the growth potential is.
Sure. All right. So what's Netflix doing in the portfolio?
Well, that's more on the application. It's streaming. Mm-hmm. It's really the exposure to the streaming. We believe, you know, that's going to be a significant part of every entertainment become a big thing. And streaming is definitely the you know, fast growing part. Or we don't have Disney Plus yet. I wouldn't be surprised if maybe at some point we throw that into the portfolio. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. It's such a competitive space. If you look at AT&T, just what they just acquired, HBO Max, and then you've got Discovery also coming out with some huge amount of content in early 2021. So yeah, it is definitely a competitive space, but I do get it as part of the thesis. So that does make sense. And then of course, we got to give a shout out to Zoom too, which we're using right now, because that is holding. I'm guessing it's low down the list because of the valuation also, I'd have to imagine.
We actually started with a higher, you know, more allocation, but we took profit along the way. And now we cut it to the 50 bips, around 50 bips.
Makes sense. I mean, they're growing into the valuation. The pandemic has certainly helped with that a ton, unfortunately. but yeah, I get some allocation there also. So I guess if we could just get into one more name, and I'll let you choose it in the portfolio that investors are probably less likely to be familiar with, does not have to trade in the US, can trade anywhere, that you think will really drive performance in the coming year. What name would you mention? Something that we haven't brought up yet.
In the coming year, there is one coming. It's in our top holdings. I forgot the top five or top six. It's called Meituan.
Okay, that's your number four right now. I'm looking at it.
Yeah, it's people call it the local. It's a Chinese company.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows Baba. Very few people actually know Meituan, and they are we call it the local services of Amazon in China. That's just how significant they are, and it's a fantastic business model. Huge, you know, TAM. They do a couple of things. You know, like food delivery. That's the cornerstone business. They manage that business so well, they become profitable. The unit economic is just improving through the year and they keep improving. And they also do the ambition of this business is everything around your local services, around the services, they are gonna touch it. They are gonna become the leader of that. They also get into the payment space and it's a fantastic business in the digital economy. And significant mode, I believe people actually like underappreciate it. You know, when you have all those, you know, small businesses, you know, joining you, your program and the delivery forces, you know, you have to manage it and also join you, that's significant mode. They do that through good technology and manage that efficiently. And now to mention other, like they get into other growth like areas.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we believe they still have the huge potential. Maybe even higher potential than Tencent and Baba.
Wow.
So we like it very much. And we still think they have, you know, a huge potential.
Nice. So does Esoterica have plans to roll out additional funds? Or are you going to be focused on Wuji for the time being? What's the outlook?
We do. You know, I can discuss our, like, from the firm's perspective, our plan.
Mm-hmm.
We want to serve. We want to be the next generation investing firm, you know, do things differently. And from the products, from the how we reach out to the potential, you know, audience. And we also want to stay focused on the major themes that are going to make it different for people's portfolio. While digital economy is the flagship one, the first one. We're gonna launch the second product in January. That's a joint work with a hedge fund called Lucene Capital.
Mm-hmm.
And they're gonna the product is gonna invest in the green technology in Europe. It's also actively managed. That's how we do it. We believe we're a big believer to do thematic investing well. You have to take a active approach to know what you are doing.
And yeah.
So that's just our belief. So all the products we're going to roll out are going to take an active approach.
Sure.
So after that, I do have given our background, given our, you know, investment expertise in both US and China, for the US market, I want to bring more China focused, you know, products, you know, China new economy. That's something we're thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the cloud and SaaS space, China is 5 years behind the US. Why not create a China-focused cloud, you know, or SaaS ETF for the U.S. investors? So those are, you know, also, you know, this will be a longer term.
Sure. And again, everything will be active, as you're saying. So
exactly.
You'll be differentiated, let's say, for firms like Crane Shares, which is partly owned by CSI, of course. And so, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually. And it makes sense in general, you know, to have somebody who's charging five times as much as a very low cost, let's say, large cap US ETF. And they're essentially just a closet S&P 500 fund. And they kind of have to cover all sectors. So even if, just for example, it looks like the yield curve is going to remain flat forever, and lenders, consumer lenders, are unlikely to really offer a good ROI, you're kind of forced to invest in them. And then at that point, you know, of course, they're gonna lose to just an index fund that costs 5 basis points more often than not, because they're shaving 10 or 20 times of that off of the return every year. But in these kinds of more sector and niche oriented spaces, I really do think the approach you're taking makes a ton of sense. And again, even many indexers in the space. So I spoke to the guys at Robo not that long ago. And ostensibly, they have an index fund, except they have a committee that decides what stocks belong in the index. And there's not really any hard and fast rules there. And that actually makes a ton of sense to me, because they're looking at robotics and machine learning. And it doesn't make sense to have an index that has rules that don't really allow you to adjust to changing reality on a regular basis. So.
Exactly. I follow them as well. And I appreciate what they have been doing. I don't think they're a passive investment.
No, not at all. But on paper, they're an index. They have rules in terms of, you know, can't hold too much of any single sector or fund. And they have different tiers, modified cap weighting, kind of an approach there. But yeah, I agree. This is not a Russell style. Just what are the 1,000 biggest companies? Put them in the portfolio. That's 1,000.
Exactly.
So, yeah, definitely not that kind of an approach.
Yeah, they do their homework. They know what they put into the portfolio. I think that matters.
Yes.
And they capture the big themes, and that's what matters.
Yeah, definitely. So before we go here, and this has really just been a fascinating conversation, I'm positive the listeners are going to enjoy it at least as much as I have. Where's the best place for investors that would like to continue researching everything we've been discussing here today to go to find more of what you guys have been putting out? You have some really interesting things on your site, for example. Where can people find you?
Okay. A good question. And we are very, very much committed to helping retail investors. And we walk the talk. And actually, we generate content on a daily basis. If you come to our LinkedIn account and our Instagram, we do stuff. We generate content on a daily basis. We have been writing a weekly newsletter and for more than a year. And so people can sign up our weekly newsletter as well. So that's where we keep people posted. And also we write blogs and publish on our website. And that's another, place you can find our thinking. We're gonna, in the 2021, we're gonna do more video oriented, research offering, either seminar or like just a quick video. That's we're trying to improve our game a little bit better. Well, hopefully people are going to see us all over the place on the social media, online. We are very committed to this building, this D2C approach. And let's see how that goes.
Nice. And just so people can find it, it's esotericacap.com. So esotericacap.com. The resources section in particular has library white papers. I'm looking at it right now. Really well-designed site also, I have to say, just nice to look at. So
thank you.
Cool. Anyway, I want to wish you really just luck and health in the coming year, Bruce. And I hope we can do this again sometime. You've got a new fund coming out. So I guess I like to generally wait until funds have some track record before, particularly active, but really any fund, just to, make sure that it's trading at tight spreads and all the rest and be able to understand what kind of things have been happening in the portfolio and the space since the fund came out. But I'd love to have you back on a few months after that launch.
Thank you very much. We would love to contribute to the conversation on your place. Things are interesting, and the new trend we're observing in the digital economy, in the green technology, whatever we can contribute, we would love to do that. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Absolutely.
Much appreciated.
Anyway, all the best.
You too.
For disclosures, Bruce Liu is long Wuji. Jonathan Liss doesn't have positions in any of the stocks or funds discussed in today's show.
If you've been enjoying Let's Talk ETFs, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And if you find this podcast useful, please consider leaving a review on one of those platforms so that other investors can discover it. You can also find this podcast on SeekingAlpha.com by typing Let's Talk ETFs into the search bar at the top of the site.